New Eden's 3-year anniversary celebration was held on the shore of Lake Shakespeare. The entire colony seemed to be in attendance. Fireworks were to follow Governor Kenji Watanabe's Settlement Day address. It was a hot afternoon, too hot, in fact, the third exceptionally hot day in a row. But as the artificial sun completed its mini-arc in the dome far above their heads and the light began to dim, the expectant crowd forgot about the heat. Out on the lake, a large yacht could be seen approaching the picnic area. Bright colored lights and pretty girls decorated its long deck. Patrick Wakefield happened to pick out his sister Katie among them. The name Nakamura was emblazoned on the side of the boat, and its owner, Toshio Nakamura, who had been known on the Santa Maria as the King of the Convicts, was standing at the helm. Nakamura had already made it very clear that he intended to extend his rule to include all of New Eden. One of the people watching this display was Eponine, who had lived in fear of Nakamura on the convict ship. As she sat watching his garish display from where she was seated on the grass, she heard her name being called, but looking around could not see clearly in the dim light. After a few seconds, she saw Ellie Wakefield, who was one of her students, waving. She started in Ellie's direction, and along the way she inadvertently bumped into a toddler who was roaming by himself in the grass. "Kevin!" a mother shrieked. "Stay away from her!" In an instant, a burly blonde man grabbed at the little boy and held him away from Eponine. "You shouldn't be here," the man said. "Not with decent people." Ellie ran to Eponine, led her to her family's big table, and made a general introduction. "It must be very difficult," said Nicole, her head nodding in the direction of the gawking bystanders.
"Difficult," Eponine thought. "That's the understatement of the year. How about absolutely impossible? It's not bad enough I have some horrible disease that will probably kill me. No, I must also wear an armband so that others can avoid me if they choose."
3 years ago today, Kenji Watanabe began his speech, a scouting party from the Pinta first set foot in this new world. At present, a number of challenges face our colony. If we work together, we can meet these challenges. This is the primary theme of this My Last Settlement Day address. The following example illustrates my point. Richard Wakefield has explained, both on television and in public fora, how the master scheme that controls our weather is based on certain assumptions about the atmospheric conditions inside our module. Since most of our scientists believe that our unusual weather the last 4 months is a result of unduly high levels of carbon dioxide and smoke particles in the air, my government has made specific proposals to deal with these issues. But all of our recommendations have been rejected by the Senate. And why? Our proposal to impose a gradual ban on fireplaces, which are totally unnecessary in New Eden, was called a restriction on personal freedom. Our carefully detailed recommendation to reconstitute part of the GED network so that the loss of plant cover resulting from the development of portions of Sherwood Forest and the northern grasslands could be offset was voted down as well. The opposition argued that the power consumed by the new segments of the GED network would result in painfully stringent electricity conservation measures. Ladies and gentlemen, it is ridiculous for us to bury our heads in the sand and hope that these environmental problems will go away. I cannot believe that so many of you accept the opposition's wishful thinking that we will be able to figure out how the alien weather algorithms work and tune them to perform under these unanticipated conditions. What colossal hubris!
Nye, who was listening with Nicole, whispered, "He's lost them. He's been too pedantic."
The crowd was getting restive, and the Nakamura yacht, which had been anchored just offshore for the fireworks, had pointedly departed soon after Governor Watanabe began to speak. Kenji now began to speak about the retrovirus RV-41. Since this was an issue arousing strong passions in the colony, audience attention increased markedly. The governor explained how Dr. Turner and his staff had made heroic strides in understanding the disease, but more funding was needed for research. Kenji decried the hysteria that had forced the passage of a bill, even over his veto, requiring all those colonists with RV-41 antibodies in their system to wear red armbands. Dr. Turner has repeatedly affirmed that this disease, like most retroviruses, cannot be transmitted except by blood and semen, Kenji continued. The armbands are unnecessary, and these unfortunate people face enough anguish. Boo! A man in the crowd shouted out, and the people around him laughed and applauded. The crowd was becoming unruly. Kenji had intended to go on to a discussion of the wisdom, or lack thereof, of extending exploration of Rama outside of New Eden, but instead he abruptly concluded his speech. I ask you to envision another settlement day, hundreds of years in the future. Will you have left your descendants a world in which they will have a good chance of finding happiness? When the settlement day picnic ended, Max Puckett, who was sitting with the Wakefields, with whom he had become friendly during the colony's early days, invited Patrick Wakefield to spend the night and the next day at his farm. They stopped in on the way at Vegas, New Eden's first casino. This was not a place that Max was terribly fond of himself, but he thought Patrick, who had never been there, would find it worth seeing. Patrick was impressed by the glitz and bustle of the place, until they happened upon Katie, who was shooting craps at one of the tables. Katie, Patrick called. She stopped in mid-throw of the dice and turned around.
Well, I'll be damned, it's my baby brother.
You're drunk, Katie.
No, Patrick, I am flying. I am on my own personal shuttle to the stars.
Vegas was Toshio Nakamura's creation. Nakamura had built upon the convict support base he had established on the Santa Maria, expanded his personal contacts, and had been able, as soon as banks and currency had been created, to begin building his empire. By the colony's third anniversary, he was already well on his way to fulfilling his desire to become the richest and the most powerful person in the colony. He had begun his climb to the top with the idea that the best products to sell in New Eden were those that provided pleasure and excitement. His first venture, a small gambling casino, was an immediate success. Next, he bought some of the farmland on the east side of Hakone and built the colony's initial hotel, along with a second, larger casino just off the lobby. Parlaying his investments shrewdly, Nakamura was soon in a position to offer to buy one-fifth of Sherwood Forest, which bordered Hakone, from the government. His offer allowed the Senate to forestall higher taxes that would otherwise have been required to pay for initial RV-41 research. Part of the burgeoning forest was cleared for Nakamura's personal palace, as well as a glittering new hotel casino complex that he called Vegas. When Kenji Watanabe's policies began to conflict with Nakamura's personal agenda, Nakamura had decided that he should also control the government. But he didn't want to be saddled with the boring job himself. He needed a dupe, so he recruited Ian McMillan, the hapless ex-commander of the Penta. Nakamura had promised McMillan the governorship in exchange for fealty, a pledge that Nakamura was now poised to make good in the upcoming elections. Nicole stood on Mount Olympus looking out across the colony. It was some months after settlement day. Earlier that morning, she had seen Richard on his way. Richard had been headed for the central plain outside the walls of New Eden, where he was engaged in learning how to control the Raman command center that regulated New Eden's weather. The project had been mandated by the politicians, who were hoping that its success would make the legislation of unpopular conservation measures unnecessary. Richard, of course, hated that kind of thinking, which he termed, avoid the issue as long as possible. "We have agreed to participate in this democracy," Nicole had told him. She was also concerned that a refusal from Richard would reflect badly on Kenji, whom everyone knew to be their friend. In response to Nicole's pleas, and because none of the other colony engineers understood the weather control process, Richard had agreed to tackle the task. He had insisted, however, that he work essentially alone, with only the Albert Einstein biots helping him. After Richard left, Nicole had decided to try to ease some of her stress by taking a long walk. But even now, standing on the highest point in New Eden, she found it impossible to escape her troubles. In the distance, the splashes of light that marked Nakamura's Vegas reminded Nicole of Katie.
Such natural talent, Nicole thought, a dull heartache accompanying the image of her daughter.
She wondered how Katie fared in the glittering whirl on the other side of the colony, knowing full well she was unlikely ever to hear from her daughter again. Richard and the three Einsteins passed through the checkpoints at the exits leading out of New Eden and its surrounding annulus and were soon in the region just outside the colony. When the Senate finally voted to develop and deploy a penetrating probe to test the environmental conditions just outside their module, Richard had been afraid that the external environment might be overwhelmingly hostile, and he lost credibility when the environment in Rama turned out so similar to New Eden's that the human explorers did not even need their spacesuits. Within weeks, the colonists had completely mapped the area of the central plain now open to them. New Eden and another almost identical construct, the habitat for a second life form, were enclosed together in a larger, almost rectangular region whose extremely tall, metallic gray barriers separated it from the rest of Rama. The barriers on the north and south sides of this larger region were extensions of the walls of the habitats themselves. On the east and west sides of the two habitats, however, there were about 2 kilometers of open space. Richard and the other technological personnel were convinced that the massive cylindrical structures at the 4 corners of this outer rectangle contained the fluids and pumping mechanisms whereby the environmental conditions inside the habitats were maintained. Upon exiting from New Eden, Richard and the three Einsteins headed for the igloo-shaped control center, where they had already been trying for some time to break into the master control logic governing New Eden weather, with little success. Today, however, Richard had decided they would make one last attempt to decode the weather algorithm. Richard and the Biots stopped first at a site near the colony exit. A group of architects and engineers were conducting a feasibility study for an external village that could house the RV-41 carriers. The conversation made Richard furious, and he moved on. He and the Einsteins continued on, past the site where a group of humans and Biots were probing the second habitat with a compact laser drill. The drill was slowly expanding the hole in the metal. "How far have you penetrated?" Richard asked Marilyn Blackstone, a fellow Brit who headed the probe effort.
"So far, only about 35 centimeters," she replied. "We're taking it very slowly. If the wall has the same thickness as ours, it will be another 3 or 4 weeks before we're all the way through."
Richard went on to his own work site at the control center. After weeks of detailed analysis, Richard and the Biots had determined that the control center and the cylinders communicated by exchanging microwave transmissions. They had then analyzed the microwave transmissions and constructed a transmitter of their own. The problem then became one of tuning the response time of the command signal to within a femtosecond of the transmissions from the cylinders, in the hope that the cylinders would accept the human transmissions instead of the control centers. If this approach didn't work, Richard intended to abandon the project. That afternoon, he and the Einsteins got the transmitter up and running. The first attempt at a transmission was a complete failure. On the next attempt, they sent a transmission within an even smaller time slice, and a loud alarm sounded. Within seconds, a wraith-like image of the eagle appeared in the air above Richard and the Biots.
"Human beings," the holographic eagle said, "be very careful. Great care and knowledge were used to design the delicate balance of your habitat. Do not change these critical algorithms unless there is a genuine emergency."
The eagle repeated his warning and then vanished, but the entire scene was stored on the Biot's video recording system. In the end, though, it didn't make any difference. As Richard explained to Nicole several days later, "The government is not following my recommendations and is paying no heed whatsoever to the eagle's warnings. The weather people are increasing the strength of the commanded response. I dread the long-term effects of all this."